And for our reading this evening, we're turning to the Old Testament, to the book of Esther, and we're reading chapter 5. The Old Testament, the book of Esther, continuing in our studies there in chapter 5. We read the whole chapter. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the palace, in front of the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the hall, facing the entrance. When he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her and held out to her the gold scepter that was in his hand. So Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. Then the king asked, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom it will be given you." "If it pleases the king," replied Esther, "let the king, together with Haman, come today to a banquet I have prepared for him." "Bring Haman at once," the king said, "so that we may do what Esther asks." So the king and Haman went to the banquet Esther had prepared. As they were drinking wine, the king again asked Esther, "Now what is your petition? It will be given you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted." Esther replied, "My petition and my request is this: if the king regards me with favor, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come tomorrow to the banquet I will prepare for them. Then I will answer the king's question." Haman went out that day happy and in high spirits. But when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. Calling together his friends and Zeresh, his wife, Haman boasted to them about his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the ways the king had honored him, and how he had elevated him above the other nobles and officials. "And that's not all," Haman added. "I'm the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave. And she has invited me along with the king tomorrow. But all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting in the king's gate." His wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Have a gallows built 75 feet high and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go with the king to the dinner and be happy." This suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the gallows built. And may the Lord be again pleased to speak to us from this chapter as we'll consider it later in the meeting. Now, as we consider together this evening chapter 5 of the book of Esther, we are nearly at the tipping point in the book. Chapter 3 reminds us of Haman's plot. Haman's plot has been hatched. It's the murder of the whole of the Jewish race. Mordecai has come up with a plan. That was chapter 4. It involves Esther approaching the king uninvited. This chapter, chapter 5, deals then with Esther's plea. What we'll notice is there's nothing hurried in it, although certainly the times were urgent. But there's a very clear plan that she has in mind. And for simplicity's sake this evening, we can remember the details of chapter 5 under three headings. First of all, we have Xerxes' favour. Esther is to approach the king uninvited. You don't do that in Persia. You come as a result of invitation. You don't put yourself in a position to be refused because it couldn't mean death. So Xerxes' favour, we notice in verses 1 to 3. Secondly, we'll notice Esther's feast. Now, throughout the whole book of Esther, it seems that they're eating all the time. Well, here there are another two feasts, one that is takes place in this chapter and another that is prepared for the following day. So again, Esther's providing the feasts here. And then from verses 9 to 14, we consider this cameo, really, of Haman, Haman's folly, the things he trusted in, the things that motivated him. We'll see rage there. We'll see pride there. We'll see malice there. And in one sense, all these are bound up in the life of this man. And although he seems to be at the pinnacle, he seems to be in such great position of influence, as we've read those verses in James, we do not know what a day can bring forth. And pride often, and nearly always, comes before a fall. So Xerxes' favour, Esther's feast, Haman's folly. Xerxes' favour, we notice there, on the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the palace. Reference there to that third day, 3 days, takes us back into chapter 4 and to the 3 days of fasting that had been undertaken there in verse 16. Do not eat or drink for 3 days or nights. And so this was a way that Esther could now, in one sense, prepare herself for approaching the king. That sense of mental preparation, physical preparation as well. But it also includes then this physical preparation of putting on her royal robes. They, in one sense, were robes of office. Robes that marked her out. She was the queen. She'd been appointed the queen, chosen as the queen. Now we know that there had been a previous occasion when Esther had to put on fine clothes and approach the king. On the first occasion, in chapter 2, she had no choice in the matter at all. She was but a cog in the machine of the empire. All these young women were paraded one at a time, finely dressed, into the presence of the king, for him to choose one of them to be the queen in place of Vashti. She had no choice in the matter. To have refused would have meant death. On this occasion, she's approaching voluntarily. She doesn't have to, and yet there is a constraint upon her to do so. This is the understanding she has from Mordecai, that this is something she must do. Mordecai suggested to her, perhaps, that she'd been raised up for this very moment. And she's come to that point of submission and willing submission to say, well, I will go into the presence of the king, and if I perish, I perish. She goes with a sense of trepidation because she mentions in chapter 4 and verse 11 that she'd not been into the king's presence for 30 days. And she perhaps was wondering, have I fallen out of favour with him? So she places herself, we read, where she may be seen by the king from a distance. The king, we are told, is sitting on his royal throne, involved in the business of the empire. And it all now depends on him. Would he be disposed to see her? Would he be disposed to allow her to approach him? Would he be willing to listen to what she has to say? Now we know from the opening chapters of this book that Xerxes is a man of the flesh. He's not a believer. You can't speak of him as a God-fearing king, as some of the kings in the days of Israel was. He's a man of the flesh. He's so much guided by the eye and the desires in his heart most of the time. And so we read that as then he notices Esther, he sees her, verse 2, when he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her. He was pleased with her. And so he holds out to the gold scepter, which admits her into his presence. And then we read that he simply asks her, what does she want from him? He's obviously assumed that she wouldn't have come into the court unless she had something to ask him, something to share with him. And he's quite open and ready and willing for her to approach him and to ask. And he seems, in one sense, quite eager that perhaps it should be resolved. So whatever it is, it can be dealt with, so we can get back then to the other business of the day. So it's not that he's turning her away, but you get the impression that he's saying, well, what is it? What do you want? I'm generous, I'm open, I'm ready. I'll give you up to half the kingdom. What is it you need so that he could get on with other things? And this is where then we notice the approach of Esther, and we'll see it developing here. This event is sometimes mentioned then, this idea of coming into the king's presence and the king extending the royal scepter, the golden scepter to you. It's sometimes spoken of in regard to a believer coming into the presence of God, bringing their petitions and their concerns and their desires. But as we read this story, there is one really important difference, one great difference. You see, a repentant sinner may have assurance this evening that there is a ready welcome, as there was for the returning son in the parable that Jesus gave in Luke chapter 15. The returning son, was he welcomed by his father? Of course he was. He was embraced by his father. And so, also, there is a statement in John's Gospel, chapter 6 and verse 37, where Jesus speaks of those whom the Father has given him. All that the Father gives me will come to me, and whoever comes to me, I will never drive away or never cast out, never refuse, never prevent them from coming to me. So these are the sort of verses, these are the illustrations in the New Testament that counterbalance this. Here was a king who in one sense could decide, depending on how he felt in the day, whether he would allow you to come or not, or see you approaching and send you off, or even say, you shouldn't have done that, you will lose your head because of that. It's also not only true for the unbeliever, that the unbeliever has a ready and will receive a welcome from God the Father. But it's also true of the Christian who has sinned. Not to say too much about this evening, because this is where we will be turning to, God willing, next Sunday morning in 1 John chapter 2. There we read, if anybody does sin, we have one who speaks to the Father in our defense, Jesus Christ, the righteous one. So if you're an unbeliever this evening and you've not yet come to faith and you're thinking, well, this story really illustrates the problem that I have. I'm afraid to come. I'm fearful to come because a God greater than Xerxes, he knows all about me. And for me to approach him, would I be turned away? Would I be dismissed? Would I be executed? And that's why perhaps I keep a distance from ever coming. I know I should, but I'm trying to put it off because I don't know what will happen. There's uncertainty about it. Well, the gospel says, no, there's a ready welcome for you. And also, if you're a believer this evening who perhaps has trod a different path and not gone on as you should have, again, you can readily come. If anybody sins, we have one who speaks to the Father in our defense, our advocate, Jesus Christ, the righteous one. Certainly, there is still to be reverence and deep respect in approaching the living God. But there's to be no fear of ever being turned away or dismissed or punished for wasting his time. Now, there was physical favor in the mind of Xerxes. He saw her dressed in her royal robes, and his eye, he remembered her, he had favor. That's what attracted him first of all, and that spark was rekindled, immediate entry. But our favor is based upon the spiritual clothing that the Lord Jesus Christ provides for us. The finished work of Christ is the only ground upon which we can have assurance of coming into God's presence this evening. What becomes clear in the rest of the chapter is the continuing relationship that Esther has with Xerxes. What's a relationship that has already begun? They've been married for some years, we know. But this is something we can now underline. It is about requests and answers, certainly, but this approaching of the king, and spiritually speaking as well, our approach in prayer to God, it is about requests, it is about concerns, but it's not a shop counter. It's not a quick phone call to a takeaway restaurant calling out a couple of numbers without any personal relationship, personal understanding. There was nothing in us, we know, to create favor. We are all under the judgment of God because of our sins. But clothed in Christ's garments of truth and of righteousness, we are accepted in the Beloved. So that we might come then with boldness. This is what the Hebrew epistle reminds us of. This is the privilege for the believer this evening. Hebrews 3 verse 16 reads, "Let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need." So that a sense of foreboding, that sense of risk, that sense of fear that was obviously in the heart of Esther is not an equivalent in terms of the relationship of a believer or of someone who is coming to faith in Jesus Christ, seeking to unburden themselves of all their sin and their burdens and their sorrows and struggles. We may come with confidence. So that's the first point that we need to consider together tonight. Xerxes' favor to Esther, his queen, who had taken his eye and was loved by him in his heart. So our God, our Heavenly Father, has that favor upon us. And we might approach him with confidence this evening and at any time and know that we will receive a ready welcome. Now, secondly, then, from verses 4 to 8, we move on to Esther's feast. And this is how this chapter then continues to work itself out. We read that this approach then has been made. The king has allowed her to come. And so the king then wants to ask, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom I will give you." Now, this phrase, "even up to half of the kingdom," is not to be thought of as literal. It was a way of speaking. It's an idiom. It's a way of indicating the generosity of the king, his willingness to be asked. You see it equivalent in the story in the New Testament before the beheading of John the Baptist, and the royal prerogative to be able to say, "Well, this girl had danced. I will give you up to half the kingdom. I will be generous with you." No king would give half his kingdom away, but it's a way of speech. It's a way of speaking. It's a way of saying, "I will be generous." What is it? Outline your concerns to me. Now, Esther knew the cultural manners of the court, and some perhaps wondered, and you may be wondering, why it is then that Esther, having had this opportunity, didn't come immediately out and blurt out what was the problem. We certainly know in the days of Nehemiah, when he was the king's cupbearer, there was an occasion when he'd heard news about Jerusalem, and as a result of that, his heart was sad, and he was in the presence of the king, and you weren't allowed to be sad in the presence of the king. The king noticed it and asked Nehemiah, "Well, what is troubling you?" And immediately, Nehemiah offers a prayer to God, and then he speaks to the king, and he outlines his concern about Jerusalem and his desire to go up there and perhaps to do something for the people. And he speaks it, he blurts it out immediately. But in this occasion, this is now another courtroom, a sort of a situation. But Esther seems to be much slower in regards to this. She doesn't blurt it out. Now, why is this? Well, whether Esther wanted perhaps the more personal environment of bringing the king aside from the court, perhaps to a private chambers to have a meal, so that he would be undistracted from the other work that was going on in the court at the time. No distractions then to disrupt the conversation, that once she'd begin the conversation, she didn't want anything perhaps to interrupt it. You know, it happens from time to time. You have to say the right thing, but you have to say it in the right place, don't you? How difficult it is, perhaps, sometimes when you start a conversation and really there are so many other distractions. And you sometimes think, well, we just need to get aside here. I need to be aside with someone, and the phone is off and it's uninterrupted, and so we can follow this through pace by pace till we get to the end. We don't want disruption. Well, it could well have been that in Esther's mind. And there is certainly a spiritual lesson here. The danger of coming in prayer to God with a shopping list of needs and requests, and yet never thinking to dwell or to abide in the presence of God. That's something the old saints would speak much about. Oh yes, we're to bring our concerns to help us in our time of need. It's there, but also to come and to abide and to dwell in the presence of God and to enjoy his company and to develop that fellowship and relationship we have with him as our Heavenly Father. So as perhaps the queen was seeking to do that with her husband, the king, so the Christian also then to take time in developing that relationship and strengthening that sense of confidence and assurance of God's love to us. So Esther then requests that Xerxes, we read, could he please attend a banquet, another banquet again. Gives the idea of the social life of the king here in Persia, the continual round of eating and drinking. Any excuse, we say, for a meal deal. Well, off we go again. So would you come and would you have a meal with me? And then we also need to consider in verse 4 this strange request. We would think, well, if it is this personal a meeting of the king and the queen, of the husband and a wife, of a man and of a woman who want to talk about things. Well, how do we explain verse 4? If it please the king, replied Esther, let the king, together with Haman, come today to a banquet I have prepared for him. It's all ready. It's set for Haman and for yourself. Will you come to this feast that I've prepared? Well, how then are we to understand this? Did that indicate to the king that perhaps that this request, when it was going to be made, was going to be a matter of national importance, involving perhaps the government and security of the empire, so that it required the prime ministerial presence of Haman? Would there have to be a decision, and he'd have to contribute to that, and have to perhaps think about it and come up with a decree? So was it in the mind of the king this idea, well, this isn't something personal then. This is something of great significance for the nation and the empire. Or perhaps was Esther's request a way of leading Haman into a false sense of security? She knew who Haman was. She knew what Haman had planned. The information had come via Mordecai. So she would have him in her presence so she could keep an eye on him. And perhaps also provide the opportunity in that feast, perhaps, for Haman to let something out. Because we know he's a man, although initially he will restrain himself, but he's a man who will express himself. And so perhaps there would be an opportunity for Haman to say something or to do something that would expose him and his plans, which is exactly what happened in the second feast. But we're not told. We're not told the reason why Esther requested that Haman attend. So we must not guess or make up a reason. But there is, I think, something quite humorous. If you look at verse 5 for a moment, we remember the early opening chapters of this book of Esther and Vashti's unwillingness to come to this feast that the king had put on for his male colleagues and people who worked in the palace. And she refused, and all the upset that it caused. We remember the big fuss in the opening chapter about the decree brought about after Vashti refused to enter the drunken party at Xerxes' command. And then the decree having to go out because it would affect, if this was allowed to be heard and known throughout the nation, it would affect family life, it could affect the empire, the stability of the Persian Empire. And things had to be put right in terms of the priority and of a man and a husband requesting and what should be done and his wife's obedience. And for all the pomp and concern about that in the opening chapters of family life and the place of the man and all that, we read here in verse 5 of chapter 5, the words of the king, bring Haman at once. That is, I don't care what he's doing. I know he's the Prime Minister. I don't care what he's up to. Tell him to put it aside and to make his way here to the palace immediately so that we may do what Esther asks. There's a little sense of humour there. With all that opening chapters, and yet here's this sense that we'll do what Esther asks. We ponder to think, is it Esther calling the tune here then? Or is it Xerxes who could hold out that scepter to anyone who might approach him or withhold it and face the consequences? Or is it, again, we're reminding ourselves of the book of Esther, God isn't mentioned, you don't see his name in the book at all, but he's the God in hiding, orchestrating events to fulfill a purpose determined. And in the middle of the feast, Xerxes again asks what could be done for Esther. And Esther simply says, the request is not the proper request that I'm going to ask. It's a request for a reservation for 3 again tomorrow, on the following day. And she promises then to make known the request. Then I will answer the king's question. I will tell you what it is. But there's this sort of preliminary request. Let's have a table for 3 again, a feast again tomorrow. Now, the king's interest certainly would have been increased as he waited then for the following day. Was it something personal? Was it something to do with the nation? That sense of curiosity. And I think that's one of the reasons for developing this. That although times are urgent, it's to build up that position, to build up that sense of asking the important question. Esther probably thought that everything was going to plan and probably slept very well that night. It is just as well for her. And it's just as well perhaps for any one of us as we go and lay our heads on the pillow at night that we don't know what others are planning. Or we might never get a wink of rest. But there's a sense in which we go about our duties, go about our responsibilities. And the Christian can always say our lives are in the hand of God. But if we really knew what others were planning, and some of the events of recent days that are coming to light, and some of the plots that have been hatched and perhaps have been spoilt and then revealed. But there are so many other things that are happening in our nation and perhaps even in our community that we know nothing about, but perhaps it doesn't come to pass. But the planning and the hatching certainly takes place. Thirdly and finally this evening, we're turning to verses 9 to 14 to look at this little cameo of Haman again and to see the folly of Haman. In these verses, we see firstly the rage of Haman, secondly then the pride and then the malice of Haman. At this stage, although it's all kept, it seems to be under wraps or kept personal in the context of his home. What had Haman then thought about this table for 3 event? Well, we read in verse 9, he went out, having completed eating that meal and spending time with the king and queen. He went out that day happy and in high spirits. He's on the top of the mountain. What a wonderful, wonderful day he's had. And we read of him being here in high spirits. Well, the last time we read of somebody being in high spirits in this book of Esther, it was when King Xerxes in chapter 1 and verse 10 was in high spirits as a result of wine. And he then commanded Vashti to appear, something he would later regret. So we're not saying that it's never right to be in high spirits, but you need to be careful. We need perhaps in the moments of our great joy and happiness to still to be thinking about other things. Keeping our feet firmly on the ground. But on the way home from the palace, full of joy and happiness, he spies Mordecai. There he is. He catches him in the corner of his eye again. Mordecai's back in work. We know he'd had some time off. He'd been wearing sackcloth. He wasn't allowed to come into the inner court because of that. But he's back in work. But again, he's showing no respect to Haman, which Haman feels he certainly deserves. And so here it is, what's called people refer to it, you've had a lovely day, and this is the fly in the ointment, isn't it? It's the cloud in the beautiful blue sky. And it depressed him. And the rage develops, we read, in his heart. The place where all things start. This is what Jesus said. You see, it's out of the heart these things manifest themselves. And so here it is, the rage is inward. Haman, though, restrains himself and he went home. Although he's got this big plan for the destruction of the whole nation, Mordecai is really getting on his nerves. And again, we see something even in this, you see, that this God who is the hidden God, we might speak of him. You see, he can even aggravate a person to do that which he shouldn't do, to bring to pass other things. The plan was 12 months ahead, but perhaps that would be too long. It would be brought to pass, a man would be given his head, he would come to a place now where he would begin to act out on something quicker than that first plan and lead to his destruction. So we see it then. The rage developed in his heart, Haman then, we notice, comes back to his home and calling his friends and his wife together, he gives them the detail of the meal at the palace. Sometimes you had folk who've gone away to one of these garden parties and they come home and they sit you down and they tell you the lot, don't they, about the cucumber sandwiches and the other sort of things they've had to eat and who they sat by and what the queen said and what they overheard and who was dressed in what. And they give you the whole detail and there you are, you're in one sense entranced or you have to sit through it until it's finished. They give you all the details. Well, that was what it was like there in Haman's home that evening. But before he came to that, what you notice is this. Before he came to that, verse 11, Haman, what did he do? He boasted to them about his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the ways the king had honored him, and how he had elevated him above the other nobles and officials. And that's not all. Then Haman went into the details of the feast. Now, one commentator, Derek Prime, states that here then was his pride revealed. It's revealed in three ways. First of all, in his prosperity. He speaks about his vast wealth. Secondly, his pride is manifested in his posterity. He speaks about his many sons. And we know later on there were a number of sons, 10, I believe, or 7. And then his position or prominence. And prestige, he'd been honoured, he'd been elevated. And here's a man now feeling happy about himself, and he's going through, reading his CV through, in front of his friends and his wife. And then he says, it's evident as well, the pride is evident. That's not all. The self-centeredness is obvious. I am the only person Queen Esther invited, and she's invited me again tomorrow. Now pause for a moment. I don't know if you've experienced this in your own family life, but let's be fair to Haman's friends and to his wife. His great wealth, well, they knew about that. His many sons, well, I should think his wife would have known how many sons she'd had. And his prominence and the position, well, they would have followed his career. So he's sharing with them things they already know, but they've got to sit and listen to it. Have you got someone like that? Are you like someone like that? Do you insist on everybody sitting around and hearing your wonderful stories about yourself? Well, here's a man full of pride, talking about himself. He's the center stage. Certainly his wife would have known about those many sons, I'm sure. They'd probably all heard it before, but they had to hear it again. How sad to think then that this would be the last happy day of Haman's life. And he would soon lose all the wealth, his sons, and his prominence within a short time. And then advice is asked regarding Mordecai, this fly in the ointment that spoilt his day. The long-term plan for racial destruction, well, that's in place, but Haman can't wait any longer in this individual case. So something's got to be fast-tracked with regards to Mordecai. So Zeresh and his friends, rather than being true friends and a true wife and telling him, Haman, get off your hobby horse and talking about yourself and come down to earth, will you? But it costs to speak the truth. what they do. They continue to help him in this regard, and they come to a suggestion. Well, build a gallows. Build it high, and then go and see the king immediately and ask him to hang Mordecai on it for you. And then, having done that, you can go to the meal with Queen Esther, and you can enjoy the meal and be happy and enjoy the rest of the day and the rest of your life. So Haman, again, happy with this, delighted, we read, delighted with the suggestion. He probably also went to bed, certainly well fed that day, and probably well pleased, looking forward to the meal that he would be attending and the execution of his enemy the following day. And the lesson for us here is to recognize, you see, that all blessings, all temporal blessings, come from the hand of God. Even if we don't acknowledge God, there's a danger in not doing so. But we should acknowledge that all good gifts around us are sent from heaven above. Where pride makes its mistake is to treat all these things as if they rightly belong to us, as if it's something that we are, something that we have done, that has placed us in this position of influence. We have amassed it all ourselves. See, the difficulty perhaps with a self-made man is that he's always worshipping his creator. A self-made man, he's always talking about himself, what he's done, what he's achieved, and how in comparison to others. And he asks people, in comparison to others, what do you think about me, what I have done? Oh, well, he did well, but look what I've done. And I tell you again, that famous story, the man who went on talking about himself for 20 minutes, half an hour, and then stopped and said, let me pause for a minute. I've been talking about myself for so long. Let's talk about you. What do you think of me? And in one sense, it was continually being centered around that individual. So the lesson is, first of all, pride makes us treat all things as if they rightly belong to us, where we should acknowledge that all good gifts come from God. And Proverbs 27 and verse 1 reminds us, do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring forth. And that's what James in the New Testament, chapter 4, those verses we read at the commencement of our service, also underline. You do not even know what can happen tomorrow. So, in conclusion, we may imagine both Esther and Haman sleeping well with a plan in place. Esther has her plan for that feast again tomorrow, and then to speak to the King Xerxes about the problem of her people. Haman, he's also putting his head down on the pillow and thinking, I've had a good day today. We've got a plan. I'm going to deal with Mordecai tomorrow, and then I'll have another feast day with the king and queen. Placing their heads on the pillow at night, thinking and looking forward, perhaps, to what's ahead of them. But the day is not yet over, although the sermon this evening is. And there is one man who will be up all night, and we will read of him in chapter 6. And this chapter 6 is the tipping point, the turning point in the whole story. So in conclusion, let's approach God in confidence in prayer. Let us spend time and dwell in his presence and develop that relationship. And let us be warned also about the pride of life and the boasting of the world. We're following carefully these Panama Papers as a few are being read and explained time to time. And those who seemed untouchable, those perhaps who seemed no one could say anything about them, the details are coming to light. And who knows where it will end. Well, for the believer this evening and for someone who's seeking to know God, Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 5 and 6 is a good place to begin and a good place to remain as we continue this week. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight. May God bless his word to our hearts this evening. Amen.